northeast. These areas, though, on Friday will have cloud and outbreaks of rain. Elsewhere, some sunshine, more wet and windy weather, though, for the start of the weekend, Alan.
Thank you, Darren. This is BBC Radio 4, where now it's time for our Book of the Week. Lloyd Bradley's Sounds Like London explores the different styles of black music that have arrived and evolved in the capital during the last 100 years. Tonight, he's looking at the development of the African music scene. The reader is Ben Onwukwe.
We were the first all-black band to go on Top of the Pops with Music for a Gong Gong in 1971, when our album Osi Bisa was at number 7 in the charts. Teddy Osei, founder and leader of Osi Bisa, thinks back 40 years to the impact that the legendary Afro-rock band had on British music. When we got on Top of the Pops, we would be wearing African clothes. We always wore them to play our gigs, even the West Indians in the band. But on television, it made such a difference. It let everybody see we were a proud band, proud of the music we played. Something more than just a sartorial milestone was being passed. When three Ghanaians, one Nigerian, one Trinidadian, one Grenadian, and an Antiguan came together as Osi Bisa in a Finsbury Park rehearsal space in 1969, they became the first example of the genuine Londonizing of an immigrant music. Here was a band that was of London, rather than simply being in London. The idea was to come out with a fusion of original African drums and Western instruments, African melodies, jazz, rock, Caribbean, and other Western music. If something like that was ever going to happen anywhere, it would be in London, because everything it needed could be found there. During the first 2 decades after the Second World War, by far the greater proportion of Africans who arrived in London were from Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and Ghana. Like Teddy Osei, who came to study music and drama in 1961 on a scholarship from the Ghanaian government, they were here to attend university. The wave of independence in Anglophone West Africa during that time ensured that nationalistic spirit was running high among young people. Independence also played a huge part in the musical development of each country. An urban dance music style, highlife, originated in Ghana at the start of the 20th century and came to the fore when musicians began to turn away from Western music, and it took hold across Nigeria and Sierra Leone as well. By the early 1960s, there was enough going on around the universities to mean there was a big highlife scene in London. In the summertime, it would move to the town halls, St Pancras Town Hall, Seymour Hall, Porchester Hall, Battersea Town Hall, because many students would stay on in London during the break. Every Saturday there would be a Ghanaian community dance, or Nigerian, or Sierra Leonean. It was a big scene, and it was all high life, because all of West Africa was high life. From the 1960s onwards, a large number of African musicians were operating in London. They played on jazz, calypso, and big band sessions, as well as coming together as solely African bands to service the university dances, where they made the most money. They started recording in their own right during the 1950s, when Emil Shalit, who ran Melodisc, London's largest independent record label, and who was already the king of calypso, shifted his focus to transform Melodisc into the hub around which London's African recording industry revolved. High life, juju, palm wine, merengue, calypso, and jazz all got mixed together, and so too did the personnel. Trinidadians Rupert Nurse and Russ Henderson often sat in on African sessions. Sierra Leonean Bliff Rady Byne recorded for the label backed by Jamaican Mento Group, who appeared in the Melodisc catalogue in their own right as the Ivan Chin Calypso. The 1960s saw homegrown blues take over London's music scene and introduced Africans as Africans to the mainstream. In 1964, the 4th National Jazz and Blues Festival, held over 3 days in Richmond, provided a vivid early illustration. Not only did blues supplant jazz in the prestigious evening slots, but these were British blues and R&B acts. In front of a crowd of around 30,000, the Rolling Stones, the Yardbirds, and Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames had equal billing to Acca Bilk, Ronnie Scott and Tubby Hayes. Ghanaian drummer and percussionist Ni Moy Speedy Akwe was also taking part as a key member of the Blue Flames. Speedy first arrived in London in the mid-1940s. After initially performing as a fire eater, a dancer and in panto, he decided to specialise in music. A familiar face in the black clubs of Soho, he ran into Lancashire-born R&B singer and pianist Georgie Fame in the early 1960s. The two became instant friends.
We'll play a melody and turn the lights down low so the night can see. We gotta do that, we gotta do that. We gotta do that, we gotta do that.
He brought Speedy's Ghanaian drumming and percussion into his band a couple of months later. Speedy became something of a go-to guy, working with Rod Stewart, the Rolling Stones, Stevie Winwood, John Martin, the Animals, and the Small Faces. Another high-profile link between Africa and the new rock gods dated back to the Soho jazz world in the shape of Nigerian drummer Ginger Johnson. By the mid-1960s, his flexible membership troupe, Ginger Johnson's African Drummers, was in huge demand. His group was chosen, apparently by Mick Jagger himself, to be part of the Stones' massive free concert in Hyde Park in 1969, where their contribution to Sympathy for the Devil took the tune into a new dimension. By the time the Stones played Hyde Park, the 1960s were pretty much over. A new generation of blue-eyed soul fans had emerged. The soundtrack was American soul on the cusp of funk, and a live band would still be part of the night's entertainment. Ghanaian Wala Danga, future founder of the legendary Limpopo Club, was then a promoter and sound engineer. He laughs heartily as he remembers those days.
Black musicians in London had to learn many styles. Because we club owners back then, there was this thing about color. It didn't matter where you were from. All they saw was you were black. Therefore, you must be authentic. Usually, they wanted to make out they had an American soul band on. So a group of musicians who could be from different African countries and the West Indies would play soul. Or they'd want a band from Ghana. So the same musicians would be that.
The more traditional music had evolved into a looser circuit of club nights and one-off dances, and an ad hoc network of African music outlets was fueling this scene. At much the same time, Stern's Electrical Supplies in Tottenham Court Road established a reputation in this market. Being close to several universities, it did very good business among African students who needed things fixed. Staff would often accept records brought from home instead of cash for repair work. And the boxes of random singles became so popular with browsing students that the shop introduced a dedicated record counter at the back. Music sales had become the largest part of the business, and when old Mr. Stern sold up at the end of the 1970s, the new owners concentrated on that side of things and kept the name. During the next 20 years, Stern's became Europe's largest distributor of African records, with a truly massive mail-order department, and even had its own label. As much a social club as a shop, every Friday, African music aficionados of every stripe would gather to swap information about clubs, sessions, tunes, or just life in general. With so little media space given over to African music, this was where you had to go to find out about the scene, which, while simmering nicely, was doing so entirely under the radar. Although the African music scene seemed healthy throughout the 1980s, it was losing focus. Changing dance floor tastes in London were pushing the music to incorporate more soul and funk,
and it might well have evolved itself out of existence. Waladanga, though, had an idea of dazzling simplicity. Run an African music night at the Africa Centre. The Africa Centre first opened in 1964 in an old tomato warehouse in Covent Garden. The idea was to foster non-governmental relations between newly independent African nations by bringing people together on neutral, apolitical ground while offering a friendly meeting place for Africans living in London. Student-oriented, the centre seemed to treat music as a kind of anthropological experience rather than a social occurrence. While it provided a suitably cerebral hangout, it neglected that other important aspect of student life, the Friday night knees up. Or at least it did, until Wala thought up the Limpopo Club. It became one of the hottest African clubs in Europe, as Wala achieved his goal of mixing up African styles with a spontaneity that would appeal to a broad crowd. African artists, with even half an eye on the world stage, also had Limpopo in their sights. As a showcase, it was second to none. Baba Mal, Kanda Bongo Man, and Salif Keita played their first European shows at the centre, while Angelique Kidjo and Thomas Mafumo made their UK debuts there. While it might be a bit ambitious to credit the Africa Centre with responsibility for the world music boom of the 1980s, for anyone exposed to an evening at Limpopo, it was hardly going to take a series of marketing meetings to work out that African could be the new black, so to speak. Radio DJs Charlie Gillett, John Peel, Andy Kershaw, and Giles Peterson took African music to the airwaves, and the mainstream press featured the records and artists alongside their regular rock coverage. While it seemed that African music couldn't be any stronger, the problem was that to reach the mainstream audience, it had to be part of the mainstream business. The term world music came into play around this time, and no one who was involved in African music, then or now, has anything particularly good to say about it. Graham Ewens, who co-owns Retro Afric Records, African rare groove specialists, still splutters at the introduction of the world music category. African culture was diminished by being lumped in with Mongolian throat singing and Bolivian nose flutes. Even using the name Africa itself was too general. There was already a wide variety of African genres. The big-selling music from Nigeria, Congo, Zaire, and Cameroon was urban dance music, not the plinky-plonky stuff that now proliferates. African music in London, whether local or imported, appeared to have hit a wall. Today, the African scene survives in London, even if it's not really thriving. The town hall dances are still there, and Wala's Limpopo Club is still in existence. If no longer at the Africa Centre, there's also a circuit of very underground all-night warehouse parties in London, a kind of post-rave culture version of the town hall dances, which frequently pull in crowds upwards of 1,000.
Ben Onwukwe was reading Sounds Like London by Lloyd Bradley, and it was abridged by Natalie Steed. The producer was Kirstine Cameron.
Thank you.
This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency. At 0015 today, Thursday the 15th of August. The general synopsis at 1800. New low expected just west of Iceland, 989, by 1800 Thursday. High 200 miles west of Fitzroy, 1025, slow moving with little change. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira. Southeasterly, 3 or 4, increasing 5 to 7, then becoming cyclonic later. Fair, then rain or showers. Good, becoming moderate, occasionally poor. South Utsira. Westerly, backing southerly or southeasterly, 5 or 6. Rain later, good, occasionally poor later. Forties. South, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later. Fair, then rain, good, occasionally poor.